Welcome back to CCA California. My name's Tony. Thank you for being here. If you're a new listener, welcome in. If you're an ongoing listener, welcome back. Super excited for today's episode. But first, before we introduce him, I'm joined by, again, my fearless leader, Chris Arechidera. What's up, Chris?
You keep calling me that, and it's pretty intimidating. I'm doing well, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, man. I am so excited for today's episode. Like, I'm frothing. I'm, like, so excited. Because it's a friend of mine. It's a dear friend of mine. You know, this industry, a lot of the guests that we've had, they're friends of yours, you know, that are now new friends of mine. But it's not often I get to introduce someone who's in my circle.
In my wheelhouse.
So yep. I'm super excited. But we also have Nate. Hello, Nate.
Good morning.
What's up?
Yeah, I'm super stoked to be here. We're getting on the tail end of this atmospheric river here. We've been having a ton of rain, but this weekend is looking beautiful. So
yeah, long time no see, Nate. What have you been up to?
Hey, he's been busy.
I'm working at BD.
I've heard.
down south at BD Outdoors. We have a little spotty tournament in the works that's been keeping me busy. I'm super excited about that coming in May. And still working at PCPT as well. So if you guys need any tackle, come on by.
Nice. Yeah. Very cool. Well, Tony, I'll let you introduce our next guest.
All right. Well, as I mentioned, this is a very dear friend of mine. We go back,
20 years.
Yeah, shoot. Feels like it. Especially how the last couple of years have been. But my friend Diego is in the house today. Welcome, Diego. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be here.
Yeah, if you want to go ahead, give us a little bit about yourself, what you've done, your history. Let's get into that. Nobody else knows you. Let's find out.
Yeah, I've got quite a varied history. I actually started a while back with the maritime industry as part of the Coast Guard, actually. I was there for 4 years, active duty as a gunner's mate, actually. Mostly doing counterterrorism, tactical law enforcement, so not quite fishing related, but still on the water.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, and then after that, I went to college for marine biology, which is where I met Tony. We made great friends, lots of classes together. We survived genetics.
Survived.
It was so brutal. It was a test, all right.
You know, people say marine biology, you get to, you know, play around with mammals. We had one semester that was fun, and that was on Catalina. The rest was physics and hydrodynamics and math.
Organic chemistry.
OCHEM. Yeah, it's no joke.
It's not all pet and fish, yeah.
Pet and fish.
But we did survive. We got our degree at the end of it, so we are officially marine biologists. And then after that, I went to work for Fish and Wildlife. I was part of the scientific side of things, the marine region. Really part of the pelagic fisheries and ecosystem project, so handling mostly commercial fisheries and everything like that, monitoring the health of fish species and everything. Did that for about 3 years. Now I'm doing something a little different as a research writer, but I'm still happy to talk about the 3 years I spent with Fish and Wildlife and all the scientific details of how marine biology, the science, applies to the actual fishing side of things.
Nice. Well, that's, I mean, hell, Tony, I thought your background was really impressive, which it is, but Diego, holy crap. Starting with the Coast Guard, let me ask you this. With us being like in the fishing industry, with us being on sport boats and, you know, oftentimes viewing the Coast Guard as kind of the guardians of us and all that stuff. How was it from that perspective being where you are at now in terms of, as you look back on that side of your career?
It was super duper helpful. There were things that interacted with my duties at Fish and Wildlife more than I would have expected and just in unpredicted ways. First of all, getting to know just how ships navigate and seamanship. And I was a small boat crewman, so that, of course, comes in really handy with anything on the water, just knowing the actual like seamanship side of things. And then there are certain tools that we would use for the Coast Guard purposes that actually made it useful for the... Sorry, I just knocked the mic.
You're good.
They were very useful for fish and wildlife duties. Everything from monitoring AIS, which is the automatic ship identification system, so we can check which ships are out, where they are, and kind of just track who's fishing where and everything like that was a super useful tool. Knowing actually how to convert from Latin long, like on a readout, to decimal degrees, so we can map it out on like Google Maps or something like that. That turned out to be pretty useful.
Nice.
So all these like neat little tricks that I learned back in the Coast Guard as part of like our core navigation and seamanship kind of stuff And it's a little bit of law enforcement too, although I was on the law enforcement side with Fish and Wildlife. Mm-hmm. That also ended up being useful.
Wow. Very interesting. Cool. So you went in the Coast Guard before college or after college?
Kind of between two attempts at college. I first went to college up at a private school in Washington State, but then the economy crashed in 2008, so couldn't afford private school anymore. And that and all kinds of economic turmoil, like I was applying to police departments and they had hiring freezes. So that's why I was like, well, let me do something at least while waiting for this whole economic tide to wash over. Mm-hmm. So that's when I joined the Coast Guard. And then after that, I got my college paid for, so I don't have to worry about anything. And my public school education there was fully paid for by the GI Bill.
Nice. Very interesting. Have you been in Southern California this whole time?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually grew up down here. I went to Washington for something different. Loved it up there. But then, you know, when the Coast Guard stationed me down here in SoCal, and since I was down here originally, went to college down here, and Fish and Wildlife is down here.
Gotcha.
So I've kind of been down here for, I'd say, since 2000, pretty much since 2008.
Huh.
In addition to growing up here previously.
Very nice. Cool.
Very cool. I mean, that's just that career alone is pretty remarkable. And then now you move into the marine biology side, go to school and everything. I know Tony and Nate both have science questions, all kinds of them, on species and all that. So
I'm sure, yeah.
Nate, I'll let you take it away, man.
Well, sure. So being, you know, 3 years on the Fish and Wildlife, I'm curious, did you see any kind of significant improvements or decreases in, you know, a specific fishery? You know, I think what comes to mind is bluefin, you know? I mean, I know that we've put such kind of strict regulations on them in the past, and now it seems like we're starting to kind of lax on it. Or it seems like the biomass off of our coast is pretty good, but, you know, talking to the scientists, I'd like to actually find out the answer.
Yeah, the again, I was on the more commercial fisheries side, and their regulations are different from sport fishing. Sport fishing for bluefin, I think, goes year-round. I'm not 100%
just about,
sure on
that.
Yeah. Whereas the commercial fisheries season is just a few months in the summer. Gotcha. And then they tended to actually not go for bluefin as often as you might expect. They would mostly go for yellowfin, big eye, those kind of things. Even though a bluefin would be in the area, it was very rare I saw them go for bluefin. And it's not because there was not enough of them or anything. It's that they're apparently really hard to fish with a fishing trawler, like with the purse seiner. Bluefin apparently have a tendency that when they get threatened, they tend to dive down deep. And if the whole school is diving down deep...
We're familiar.
We know that all too well.
Got it.
Yeah, and if enough of them do it, they can actually like really start making a whole purse seiner list over and potentially capsize. Apparently that's happened a few times in the past, way before my time. But
based on like volume or weight?
Right, yeah. I mean, they're strong fish, and then you get enough of them going down at the same time, they're going to pull down that net. So
makes me think of that scene from Finding Nemo, you know, at the end, like, swim down, and all the fish are like swimming down in the net to break it.
Apparently that's a real thing, yeah. So that's one thing that... kind of discouraged them from going to bluefin. And also they weren't super huge, the ones that they were getting. So they ended up, I think, bringing in about the same price that the yellowfin would have been. I'm not too sure on the calculations that they do for that.
That's very interesting.
But they said they saw them out there all the time.
Huh. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of interesting. You talk about, you know, like the bluefin call moving in one direction. Because I was talking to this sport captain once who was previously a commercial fisherman. And I was asking, like, what's the most dangerous fish or like, you know, like species to like try and net? And his answer surprised me. He said market squid.
Yeah.
And the reason is because when you net market squid, they have a tendency to move as a group. And if you have 10,000 market squid all moving in one direction, they create an incredible amount of force. And they actually redesigned nets to have these like breakaway points where once the squid start kind of like moving in one direction, it'll bust through and let them start going because many, many boats were actually sunk by squid.
Yeah,
well, that's crazy. I didn't know bluefin were doing that too.
Yeah, market squid's actually the primary species that I kind of monitored while I was with Fish and Wildlife.
Interesting.
That's kind of the old standby for the commercial fisheries apparently, because again, the season's year-round for them. And they're very, very plentiful. They're very, very fast reproducing species. The only thing is that they're also a food source for a lot of other things in the oceans. So that's why you have to monitor them very closely, even though they do reproduce really quickly and you might see tons of them, is that they feed a ton of other fish and marine mammal species and everything.
Totally.
Yeah, I mean, the last couple of years alone, all the reports of the squid that were up and down, you know, Channel Islands, even down parts of down here, and the halibut were popping off, white sea bass was popping off. It was, like, phenomenal the last 2 years, like, especially the last couple of years, at least for us on the sport boat side. So I'm sure you saw a little bit of that, too, that trend is as far as the squid, the bait fish. You know, they, people say fishing is a science, and it totally is. Like, there's a reason why we're seeing some of these trends happen.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interactions between the different species. And again, market squid being one of the base food sources for tons of other species is a big part of it. The sardine fishery is actually closed for commercial fishing for that reason, although they're really recovering a lot from the overfishing.
Absolutely.
Because they're a huge fish species, you know, even though the fishing captains will see them out there all the time, huge schools of sardines. If we overfish them again, you know, that might cause population crashes elsewhere and all kinds of other effects on the ecosystem.
I remember my dad talking to me about that. I think it was back in the 80s. There was no sardine anywhere because they fished them to the point where they were almost extinct.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how those species can rebound, though. I mean, I think just marine species have such a crazy way of just rebounding once you give them some space. You know, you look at MLPAs versus like the regular areas, or once you leave some of these offshore species alone, it's amazing how they can come back in half the time we would have thought they would.
Yeah, effective management strategies really make a difference. And it's pretty crazy to see how species like that, the sardines, can go from almost extinct to now being fairly plentiful.
Absolutely.
Not enough to open their fishery back, apparently, but... there's that marine mammal management again. They're rebounding all over the place.
And it's also, I think, learning from past mistakes, you know? I mean, if the population is good, don't open it, you know, like open season again for them to start just like, you know, taking them all out, you know, just like look at it as a responsible, you know, from a conservation perspective where we don't have to, you know, in the future completely isolate them, but you know, look at it in a way that, you know, can preserve it for future generations.
Yeah, and that's part of like where, although I didn't handle licenses myself, but that's where fishing licenses and everything can be useful, is that way that gives the people that create the year-to-year strategies, we can predict how many people will be fishing in a given season, given year, and that way you know exactly how much pressure humans are putting on these species in addition to natural species, natural pressures.
Yeah, definitely. Now, one final question. Did you have any work with the gill netting up in, like, the Channel Islands?
Just the white sea bass.
I know they've put some pretty strong regulations on those, as far as I know. And just from a sport fishing side, you can kind of see the results.
Yeah, so gill nets are... There's very, very strict regulations on how you use gill nets. So for the commercial white sea bass season, it's only a few weeks in the summer.
It's only a few weeks.
It might be a month or two. I forget exactly. It seemed like it was only a few weeks, but that might just be because they would sometimes catch things and sometimes not, so they might end it early or whatever for the individual captains that I dealt with. And again, different regions will be a little bit different in terms of how well they're catching actual fish. But gill nets, you can only set them for a set period of time because anything that swims into that gill net gets caught. So very, very high bycatch potential. So fishermen will set out the net and have to pick it up very quickly so they can potentially throw anything back in the water that might survive. But otherwise, you know, everything that runs into that net is going to get entangled.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Did you talk about that at all when you were working with the Sea Bass Foundation? I mean, did you guys, like, look at gill nets or the effects of them?
Because I know,
you know, again, speaking with my dad, who was fishing all these places back in the late 70s and 80s, he's like, the good old days weren't as good as people are actually saying they were. the fishing in the past, like, 2 or 3 years has been phenomenal up there, like Santa Cruz, Santa Rosa Island.
Oh, yeah.
The halibut fishing has been off the charts. The white sea bass, not only the numbers, but the size of them has been amazing. And I think there's a correlation between the lessened commercial pressure and the better recreational fishing. There has to be.
Yeah, I mean... It makes sense, right?
Diego, going back to the bait, the sardines and all that stuff, companies like Everingham Brothers and all that catch the bait for the sport boats and, you know, private boaters and all that stuff, they're technically they fall under the commercial sector, right? But also they kind of, in a way, you kind of view the sporties at least recycling bait as opposed to consuming bait because they're not deplenishing it they're just basically redistributing it.
Yeah, they fall under a little bit different regulations than like the purse seiners or anything. Purse seiners can't really target sardines. And again, I handled purse seiners mostly, so that's just kind of what I know. And a little bit of with the gill netting with the white sea bass. They will incidentally catch some sardines. And I don't know for sure if that's what they sell to bait companies or if bait companies get all of that that they catch themselves. That I don't know too much. A lot of the light boats that use that they use for squid fishing, yeah. They actually can catch some sardines and stuff for their own bait. But it's very small quantities. It's like a couple hundred pounds. It's not like a couple tons that, you know, they could catch or purse seiners could catch, that kind of thing. And again, a lot of what I would do as Fish and Wildlife at the commercial fisheries is catalog the bycatch, whatever they get. Not because we're like breathing down their neck trying to see like, oh, are you guys breaking any laws or anything, but it's essentially for the state. It's kind of free science because we know where that purse seiner was fishing. Mm-hmm. We know what date and what times they were fishing. So we see, you know, in addition to how much they get of the species that they're targeting, whatever bycatch that they get, you know, they try and throw as much of it back as they can, but some of it still ends up in their hold. So we can then identify what it is and tally exactly where it was that it was caught and basically map out where individual fish are going to be. I've seen all kinds of crazy bycatch too. It was pretty interesting. I saw a mantis shrimp once, actually twice. Really? That was pretty cool. There's, of course, the usual sardines and everything. We'll manage again those nets somehow and everything. Right. And I'm not 100% sure what they do with the bycatch on those because they will sometimes get a decent amount of it. And even though the fishery's closed and everything, they might sell that to bait companies. Not 100% sure.
Mm-hmm. Have you been able to go, like, with your work in squid and all that, have you been able to go on those, like, bait boats with the big lights and all that stuff?
Oh, the light boats. So I haven't been on them specifically because I would meet them when they get back to shore, and that's where we, you know, that's where they unload and everything. So that's mm-hmm. where we talk to the captains and everything and get, like, a picture of what they've been seeing out there, get any trends and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also where we get our scientific samples from. We'd monitor the entire offload to see, you know, what the bycatch is and everything. We randomly sample a few squid or sardines, whatever it is that they're catching, from the offload. And that way we can take that back to the lab and analyze it.
Nice.
What was the reception when you're in your uniform, coming down with a clipboard, you got all these captains coming
that
back
guy.
In. What was the reception?
Pretty good. The commercial fisheries have pretty good relationship with Fish and Wildlife. That's something that we try to cultivate. We are, again, the science division. We're separate from the wardens. They know that we're not trying to bust them for anything. We're mostly there to kind of get whatever their observations are and, you know, get our samples so we can make sure that the fish are healthy and everything and that they're not being overfished. So they know that that's our priority. So although they are fishermen, so they tend to be kind of gruff, especially in the early morning when they're coming back from an overnight fishing expedition. We had a pretty good relationship. I became friends with a couple of the captains and everything. It was really great, actually. I was kind of expecting that already, having already been in law enforcement previously. You know, a lot of a good law enforcement is establishing a good rapport with the people that you're talking to. You don't want to go immediately to like SWAT team, SEAL team 6 kind of level or anything. So even though I wasn't law enforcement in my Fish and Wildlife capacity, you know, being able to talk to people at that kind of like low level and everything while still accomplishing your official duties and everything helps a lot to keep that relationship going. So the captains were pretty cool with us.
Cool. What kind of things would you actually do to actually establish rapport with all those guys that you have to work with? Anything like off the wall or anything?
Well, I mean, a lot of them, when they learned I was former Coast Guard, they were huge fans of me personally. I'd tell them stories and everything of what
that,
I saw.
That helps.
Yeah, definitely. but even the other Fish and Wildlife folks, they had the same job as I did and everything. Everyone has kind of their own strategy and everything for talking to people. And different people make different friends with different folks and everything. So the quality of the people at Fish and Wildlife, I have to say, was pretty excellent. Everyone there really dedicated to what they're doing, very competent. Extremely easy to work with, and again, the work ethic of everyone just blew me away, even from a former military aspect and everything. Everyone was super great. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us are also, you know, fishermen as well. We also, some of us even hunt. We also really enjoy like the outdoors and the wildlife that California has to offer. So we're not coming at this from a like, oh, we want to clamp down on everything. Like that's on our personal level, we aren't that type of folks. So Mm-hmm. the the image that like, oh, Fish and Wildlife is this big bureaucratic organization and everything, like, yeah, it is that a little bit. That's part of just what a state management agency does. But the individual people that are there usually have a pretty good understanding of where the fishermen, the hunters, and everything that we interact with, where they're coming from.
I totally see that. Yeah, I've seen that through the wardens and stuff. You know, if you're, first off, not breaking any rules or laws or anything, you have your fishing license, they're typically super stoked to see what you got. Mm-hmm. You know, like at San Diego Bay, I go halibut fishing all the time. And when I get a legal halibut, I'm like kind of stoked to show them, and they're stoked to see it. They're like, nice, that's a 26-incher. Hell yeah, dude. So I was curious. So when you collect samples of squid or maybe other bait fish, what are you looking for? Like, what kind of gives you a sense of that the population is healthy?
Yeah, that's what I want to get into.
Yeah, so we would, it's different for every species. Our sampling method and kind of analysis is different for every species that we would monitor. The squid specifically, because that's the one we dealt with the most, we would take, throughout the offload, we would take random samples. We'd take 30 squid, roughly give or take. Sometimes we get a little bit more, but that's just from, there's literally tons of squid coming off of these
Take your pick.
So we would, we use a little squid net to, you know, dip it in every now and then. We get a squid out of random, just not trying to pick anything specifically because science is based on that random sampling kind of protocol. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you start introducing bias in what you're doing. So again, everything random. So that's why we use a squid net. We don't just use our hands. And so we get about 30 squid across this entire offload, you know, some from the beginning, some from the middle, some from the end, because different sizes and of squid and everything will float at different rates, or sometimes they might be from different locations. They do sets at separate locations. So that's why you want to sample throughout the entire offload. So we get our 30 squid, and then catalog whatever bycatch we have on our clipboard. Like we saw 3 scorpion fish or something, whatever it is that we saw. Usually it's not very high amount. They're very good about throwing things back that aren't supposed to be there. They don't want those. They want the squid.
Yeah, exactly.
So we would then take our 30 squid back to the lab, and we would weigh them, measure them. For squid, you have to open them up to determine what sex they are. Huh. No way to tell externally.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Or like the heads on the males tend to be a little bit thicker, but that's not a super reliable thing. It's very subjective. So the way to like tell specifically is to actually open the mantle up and tell from the inside. So we'd catalog, you know, how many males, how many females are in the sample that we got. For the females, we'd weigh the ovaries to tell how many eggs they've got, whether they're, you know, immature eggs or mature eggs, that sort of thing. And then we would get a mantle punch. So for a squid to kind of determine, like, how well they've been eating, you can actually measure the thickness of their mantle.
That's how you do it.
Exactly. So that's how you determine kind of, like, how well-fed they are.
That makes sense.
And then for the age, we would extract the statoliths. So the statoliths are kind of like their, well, for fish, it's the otolith. That's their like ear bone kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's how you determine their age. They get rings just like a tree does. And you would extract the otoliths and count it for how many rings they've got. So squid and cephalopods, they have a statolith, which is kind of the same thing for aging. They use it actually for balance more than hearing or anything. That's kind of how they tell which way is up, because it kind of sits in these little gel-packed sinuses.
Yeah. Hmm.
So we would extract the statoliths, these little tiny, like, grain of sand things.
Wow.
And then under a microscope, we can count how many rings they got, you know, 1, 2, 3, that kind of thing. So determining the age of the squid.
And those are made out of cartilage, right? Because they don't have any bones.
No, those I think are, I don't know if they're bone exactly. They're definitely not cartilage, because the kind of, like, skull thing, that's definitely cartilage. You can just cut through that with a scalpel, no problem. But the stellas, again, they feel like a little grain of sand. So I think they're calcium carbonate, but not 100% sure. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Very interesting.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
So do they have little stomachs in there? Can you see what they're eating? Like, is that ever part of it, or is it mostly just to see how much they're eating?
You can definitely see that they have a stomach and how much is in there, but exactly what it is, I mean, it's all just kind of like this goop.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
The inside of squids are just kind of like a goop sack with another goop sack and another goop sack. So
gotcha.
After a while, I could tell, like, which part's the stomach, which part is the heart, which part is the guts, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But in terms of identifying what's in their stomach, usually not.
It's just a bunch of goop.
Yeah.
So now, you take the squid, you take all these different parameters. Now you have this database with all this different information. What do you do with that information?
Yeah, so that gets tracked from year to year. So any changes can be mapped as trends. You know, from year to year, we'll see, okay, the squid are in this region, because again, it's the whole state of California. So with locations of where each fishing boat was, there's like fishing blocks and everything. We can tell, like, okay, the squid in this region are healthier than last year, or they have fewer eggs than last year at this time, same time period. So that's that's where you can start highlighting the differences. Because otherwise, yeah, it's all just going to be kind of like this noise level kind of thing. So whatever stands out as either like above or below that kind of like natural noise level, we can identify and tell like, hey, if something's happening to these squid, what might it be?
And is there a breeding time for these squid? Because I've caught them before where there's a layer on the bottom of just egg sacs and you'll catch a ton of them. And right. then, you know, through that, there'll be squid. But it seems like that's not always the case.
Right. The squid move around in kind of cohorts where they all kind of like spawn at the same time and they move around. They feed in certain areas as this one kind of like school.
Gotcha.
And then that school will kind of age together. Hmm. So that cohort will breed at kind of like a set period each year. But in terms of like the whole squid population, I think it's year round.
Really? So all the cohorts are just kind of doing their own thing.
They're right. They're really on their own schedule kind of thing. Huh.
So the samples that you're taking, were you taking them at the same time every year? Or were you basing it off of what the commercial guys were seeing, what they were catching? How did you decide, you know, on this day we're going to go down and take samples of squid?
Yeah, so the fishing boats are pretty much out there every single night, every weeknight. And they would usually be fishing for squid because, again, that's a pretty good standby for them. They can almost always catch it. Unless there's been, like, a big rainstorm where the squid kind of, like, move away from the shore, they go a little bit deeper.
Cause like the last couple of days.
Exactly. So the last couple of days, probably not a whole lot of fishing going on. So they're pretty much out there every single day, and they'll usually go for squid, but sometimes they'll go for something else, whatever is in the area. So we would have our random dock days where, again, science, everything random. We would go so that we would sample whatever it is that they're catching on that particular day, which happens to usually be a squid, but sometimes it's mackerel. Sometimes it's, yellowfin or bluefin, that kind of thing when it's that season. So with those random dock days, we go in at, you know, 6, 7 a.m. whenever they're coming back and just see what they got. If they have an offload, we'll take our samples from that. And then that's exactly how we get our schedule.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And do you move up and down the coast, like tracking these different boats, or is it all through like one harbor?
No, it's based out of individual harbors because the big fisheries that we monitor and everything, they're based out of San Pedro, they're based out of Santa Barbara. So we have personnel at each kind of location that will take a look at it.
That makes sense. Okay, because I mean, just down here in San Diego, we do have squid, but unless you're like really in the know, you're not really on it. Yeah. I know in the Channel Islands and out of San Pedro, it's pretty solid all
in
the time.
Volume there.
And actually, now that I think about it, we did have personnel down here in San Diego that focused mostly on bluefin, yellowfin, that kind of thing. It's just up in San Pedro, LA area where I am, you know, that it was mostly squid that we dealt with. It was just incidentally would be bluefin, yellowfin every summer, that kind of thing.
Did you ever get to dissect bluefin or yellowfin during your time there?
So we didn't end up dissecting them because they're really valuable. We don't want to take them from the fishermen. Even just a couple from a random sample or something like that. I mean, that's, you know, 30, 50 pounds of fish potentially. Yeah. So we would use a different analysis method for them is that we would actually measure them, weigh them there at the dealer so that we can put the fish right back into their stock. We would determine, you know, for sure if they're bluefin or yellowfin because they can be kind of hard to determine, especially with certain colorations and everything.
For sure.
So if they're a bluefin, we'd take a little quick fin clip just for genetic sampling, and then that goes to NOAA Fisheries, who has a big running program where they analyze the DNA for bluefin to do their own thing with the health. And I don't know exactly what they're doing, but that's the additional thing for bluefin. Yellowfin is mostly just the length, the weight, that kind of thing.
How successful is that fin clip program for bluefin?
It seems pretty good. I believe that that's also coordinating with other countries. So like Japan's another big one. So NOAA Fisheries being the big federal agency, they will be able to talk with other countries that are involved with bluefin management because, again, they're a highly migratory species. So with their genetic data, they probably compare that with other countries that are also getting it and determining which school is going where at different times of year, you know, exactly what their patterns are, that sort of thing.
That was going to be actually my next question is, did you guys ever work with the fishery management in Mexico? Like, or was that a pretty strong line that kind of, because I know that there is a commercial bluefin fishery down there, and I'm wondering if you guys kind of communicated.
I remember seeing saners out there. We'd see bonita like earlier in the year, and they'd be in copious amounts. And then we'd see the saners roll up from Mexico, and then the next day, poof, gone. Mm-hmm. Didn't see bonita.
Yeah, we didn't too much at the state level. Again, that's going to be a little bit more the federal agencies, yeah. just because it's another country and everything. Gotcha. The federal government, that's their wheelhouse. We would, of course, if we got something weird or something, like that, we would talk with whoever we had as a contact in the Mexican equivalent of Fish and Wildlife or anything, but that was kind of beyond what I would deal with.
Gotcha.
At my, like, deck plate level, let's get some science kind of thing.
Totally.
Was there often a lot of collaboration between you at the state level and the feds, too, with NOAA and all that?
There definitely is a huge interaction. Again, a little bit above what I was usually dealing with, but mm-hmm. a lot of our... you know, our presentations and everything that we get, like, every 6 months or something like that, we'd get mm-hmm. Filled in as to, like, what people are seeing in different agencies, different regions, that sort of thing. Any new, like, laws, regulations coming down the pipeline. And also communicating back what we hear at council meetings. Again, we have people that go to fishery council meetings and everything where company owners, I believe sport fishermen organizations, mm-hmm. too, have a presence and everything. So we would all, again, coordinate what they're hearing at council meetings with what we see on the scientific level and everything.
That was my next question. Did you often have to go to Fish and Game Commission meetings or PFMC and all that? Do you do any presentations?
Me specifically, no. We definitely had people that went all the time. Mm-hmm. They were seemingly constantly at council meetings and everything. So they, again, have a pretty good presence there and listen to folks as often as they can just to see what the... the fishermen are ones out there all the time, so mm-hmm. we get more science from them and more data, but also input on how regulations are impacting things, what's working, what's not, what's more difficult for them, what makes their lives easier. And then we filter that back up to the elected representatives and everything, because they're the ones that really set the policy for everything, the Fish and Game Commission and everything.
Yeah.
So again, we act as the go-between from people at the fishing level to people at the decision-making level.
Gotcha. I mean, in your opinion, you know, with you formerly with CDFW and all that stuff, there's always going to be a need for, you know, I guess more science. And you even alluded to a term that I had never heard before, free science.
Right.
that's cool. You know, in your opinion, there's always stuff that we can do more on and all that. But right now at the state level, are we doing enough of the science in terms of studying different species and all that?
There's a big push to really update the way the state does management, does science and everything, and really leverages the kind of citizen science level of things. One of the things that I dealt with, especially when COVID hit and everything, that really tamped down a lot of our operations. So one of the things that I did, while we couldn't really go out sampling or anything, and some folks were fishing still, but it was hard for us to actually manage with COVID regulations and everything, how to sample it from warehouses and stuff, because we just didn't have much knowledge on how to keep yourself safe yet. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I did was helped update the marine species portal, which is part of the CDFW website. And that's something that everyone can access, has species identification guides. It has, if you're interested, like their life cycle, their habitat, even has fishing tips and like what kind of fishing gear and regulations are applicable to individual species. It used to be a very bare bones kind of like online thing back when, you know, they first established the CDFW website in like 1999 or whatever. so we really did a big push during COVID to update that with more species, more info, better pictures and drawings and everything, and make it much more 21st century and everything, so folks can access it and really see, well, what is this fish that I got, if they don't have a fishing guide or something that has it or anything. It's much more authoritative.
That's a great resource.
Yeah. And then it also has resources where you can look up current fishing regulations, anywhere on your mobile device, on laptop, whatever. And mm-hmm. then there's also a contact which goes directly to marine region staff. Instead of having to like cycle through like the big CDFW organization or anything, it's an email contact directly to them. So folks, if they have questions or anything, or they see anything, they can just contact marine region staff directly, and we're the folks that know what to do with that data. It doesn't have to like bounce around the inside of the organization while it goes directly to marine region.
Cool.
So that, let me actually give you the website for that, because yeah, I'm quite proud absolutely. Of what we did with that. So that's marinespecies.wildlife.ca.gov. And nice. Again, that's the marine species portal.
We'll have to drop that down in the show notes for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so some of those were written by yours truly. Some of the
nice.
Info like on black sea bass and everything, I wrote exactly some of the up-to-date info about them, their life cycle and how to identify them, all that sort of fun stuff.
Wow. Do you have any information on the Black Sea Bass? How is the population doing? Do you have any
how
idea?
Are they doing?
They've been closed for quite a while.
They are still closed. They are recovering very slowly. I actually was scuba diving in Catalina last year and saw my first one out in the wild, which was pretty neat. Really, really cool. But yeah, they're still very, very low population. The thing is, they're a slow growing species. They take a long time to reach maturity, and when they do, they don't have a huge success rate of hatchlings going to adulthood, because when they're small, they're great prey species for lots of other things. So once they're big, they got some protection, but when they're small, I mean, they pretty much have to stay in the shallows and hope nothing comes and eats them, sort of thing. So it takes them a while to really bounce back, and that's a big difference between a slow-growing species and a fast-growing species. It's something like sardines bounces back fairly quickly because they grow all the time.
Right.
Black sea bass, being giants that they are, takes a while to gain that mass.
How slow do they actually grow? Do you know?
I'd have to check the notes on that because I can't remember off the top of my head the exact number of years it takes for them to reach maturity. But it's more than sardines.
Well, we had talked about squid a bunch, which I know you were heavily involved with. Do you have any other, or do you remember any other big projects that you worked on with other different species and anything?
Well, we also got mackerel a decent amount. So Pacific mackerel usually is another thing that commercial fishing boats would go out for quite a bit. They don't go for them as often because they don't get as much money for them as squid, and they're not as reliable an income source. And then I think a lot of that went to canneries overseas, too. So they'd have to arrange shipping and everything like that.
Do you ever see any soury?
No, not that I can recall.
It's definitely a warmer water.
Yeah.
Little bait fish. Have you ever seen a soury before?
I've seen souries before. I've seen tuna chasing them.
Yeah. We would see them in their stomachs. Mm-hmm. Like this past season. When we'd fillet bluefin. Or, when we'd gill and gut them before we drop it down. Mm-hmm. We'd see tiny. I'm talking
baby souries.
Inch to 3-inch souries. One was pretty big. It was 5-6 inches. But most of them were really, really tiny.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. But that was their food source. So we were thinking maybe it's a transition year between La Nina going into El Nino. Maybe these warmer water pockets that are kind of starting to bubble up this way are causing those souries to come up.
Maybe. Definitely.
Well, one thing we definitely saw a lot of were pyrosomes. The little sea pickles.
Yeah.
Selps.
Yep. Absolutely.
Well, they're not selps, actually.
Not selps. No, not selps.
We saw selps, too, but pyrosomes are actually, they're related to selps, but they're normally down in the Baja, Mexico kind of area, but now with the warmer waters up here, that we're seeing a ton of them.
They're related to tunicates?
Yes, actually. They're related to tunicates, not selps. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're related to sea squirts, and they're just tons of them. They were actually clogging the nets at some points for the big purse seiners.
Really?
And they kind of look clear sea cucumbers, right?
Yeah, exactly. So again, that's where they get the name sea pickle and everything. They're called pyrosomes because apparently they light up really bright at night if you punch them or something. But they're a little too deep for most boats to kind of bump into. So I haven't seen them light up myself, but that's where the name pyro comes from in the pyrosome.
When we would fish for bluefin, the most amount of these pyrosomes that we would see was earlier in the year, when all these big ones are around. So May, June into July, those transition months. And I remember there was a week where they were littered everywhere. And this is when all the molas were around and they were just chomping on the selps. And it was a minefield of molas.
Oh, I bet. I was going to say, there was all those Valelas last year, the little wind sailors or whatever.
They have those
little
those.
Fins, and the molas were going nuts on them. They were eating them full speed. But getting back to mackerel fishing, it's interesting because I actually have a buddy who, he's a one-man show, but he commercially fishes for mackerel.
Hmm.
And it works for him because, he launches out of Mission Bay and he mostly just fishes around San Diego, so gas costs are way less. The fishing is pretty consistent. The way he does it, I think he does it with hook and line, but I don't know. But he gets a bunch of them, and the way that he makes money is that he sells it to these specific markets that mostly sushi restaurants and things that have these mackerel that they want them day of or the next day or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that it's an untapped kind of fishery. There's all these bluefin fishermen going way out, you know, and spending like $2,000 in gas every single trip. And this guy is just smoking the local mackerel population, and he's making his living. It's funny, you know. I mean, so did they net those things with purse seines?
Yeah, and I think those they actually sold to pet food companies. From what I remember hearing is that some of them would end up getting put into kibble or something like that. So I think that's where they got more of the reliable kind of sales kind of thing. Because sushi restaurants don't serve that much mackerel.
I didn't think so. Yeah. Because this guy, I guess he has just a couple of vendors or buyers or whatever, mm-hmm. and he supplies them, but he makes it work. And he fishes mackerel like 5-6 days a week. That is what he does.
And like year-round?
Year-round mackerel.
It's a lot of mackerel.
It's a lot of mackerel.
It's a lot of sabikis.
It's a lot.
Yeah. True. Yeah, oh, my goodness. Diego, I heard a rumor from somebody that's sitting right next to you. They used to be on a spotter plane, or that have ridden on spotter planes.
Yeah, so that's another thing that we would do periodically, or aerial surveys. And then the scientific value of that is pretty obvious. If we can actually fly over and actually see a rough estimate of how much tonnage of particular species is in each sector that we would do, we'd do transects, so we just do a line up and down the coast in certain regions.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, with an app, would actually geolocate each school, as I would actually hit like exactly when we saw a particular observation and then write down how much tonnage it was. Then we compile that into these maps that we can then submit to the Fish and Game Commission, to scientific organizations, to NOAA Fisheries and everything, in addition to using for CDFW's own regulation purposes. Mm-hmm. And that gives us, again, much more data than you might get from a fishing trawler, because we can actually do this entire like miles long transect and just see what's there. It does have some limitations, because you can actually obviously see the fish only when they're close to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding that limitation, you can combine it with other data to get a much fuller picture than just what, you know, fishing trawlers report or catch, or what a sport fisherman might catch in certain areas, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing what that perspective opens up.
Yeah.
There's these crazy photos of like a boat on the edge of a football field of tuna or something like that. And they've got no idea it's there.
Yep.
And there's just thousands, literally thousands of fish swimming all around, you know? Yeah.
You can see a lot more from the air, that's for
sure. Absolutely.
We actually had a spotter guy who can identify the fish from the air. So we would fly about 1,500 feet, so closer to the ground than you would usually fly, but it's still pretty high up. And just based on kind of like the swimming patterns, just kind of how they look, a little bit of coloration, you can't really tell like individual stripes at that distance, but like the general like color of the fishing school, you'd be able to tell us which school it was.
It's
like
really
what
cool.
Species.
That's so cool.
I've actually talked to some of the spotter plane guys, and it takes a really trained eye, because you're really looking at the way the bodies are moving, you know, like a pod of dolphin, you know, from 1,500 feet, if you don't know, looks like a pod of 200-pound bluefin or a school of bluefin. Ugh. But the way, right? I'm sure Tony knows all about it. But
they're not. That's a porpoise.
Those are dolphins. But, like, it just takes so much time, and especially when you're looking at specific, you know, even bait fish and things, you know? I mean, that takes a long time. But it's cool. It's cool how
they started on sword fishing boats.
Yeah.
And so he just being on like the front of on the boat on the forecastle, he would be able to like look overboard and just observe the fish as he was looking for swordfish. And that's how he kind of got his training, is just a real on the job, real classic seaman kind of thing.
That's super cool.
Figuring how fish move. And now he's in planes riding around looking for fish.
Did you ever get in contact with Air Pilakia?
No.
You know who that is?
No, it doesn't ring a bell.
He's one of the spotter guys down here.
Gotcha.
That's what I'm talking about. The guy's a legend. He has some insane photos and videos.
No, the guy that we rode with, Devin, he might know him, but I don't know him particularly myself. So,
So it's almost kind of like another tool in the toolbox, as opposed to better versus worse.
Yeah, exactly. The ocean's a big place, and there's different dimensions to it. It's a whole 3D space. So trying to get data from all over is what we're doing for, and feeding these different sources of scientific data into our management strategies.
Interesting.
On the opposite side of the surface stuff, would you guys ever do like really deep water studies? Because I know there are some you know, deeper squid populations.
Yeah, there's actually, was it Cal Coffee, the project that did that? Basically, they had this kind of submersible buoy thing that they'd put out there, and they could, I forget exactly how they got their data on. I just remember seeing a couple of presentations on it, but it's another side of the PFET program and CDFW in general. that they do more deep water surveys. And usually they do that in partnership with like NOAA Fisheries or one of the big federal agencies, the folks that have a lot of resources.
Yeah.
To really do more deep water surveys. We do have a few divers on the CDFW team, and they would do mostly the abalone project.
Got it.
And from what I understand, they do a lot of the abalone surveys. There's the kind of the rehabilitation program. So they would work scuba diving for that. And of course, whatever they observe out there, they'd give us scientific data on that. But they'd mostly be just trying to keep these abalone alive.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's really tough right now with the disease that's kind of going throughout abalone, sea urchins and everything. With warmer waters comes more bacteria and other kind of diseases. So it's been really tough to kind of get them back on their feet.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. Huh.
On the commercial side, since that's kind of that's primarily where you work and all that, in terms of a conservation aspect, are you seeing a lot of those commercial guys really keeping conservation in mind when it comes to catching and all that? I know it's kind of a tricky question for that side because it's their living. But do you see more conservation, I guess, measures or practices on their end?
Yeah, they're definitely eager to keep fish around. They will sometimes even not go out fishing if they notice that the squid that they're catching are very, very small. They'll intentionally wait a few days, weeks, whatever it is for fish, squid, whatever it is to grow. So they're more mature and can actually keep that population stable because it doesn't do them any good to fish everything this year and then have nothing to fish next year or 2-3 years after that. So they do actually, especially the older guys, they really have a much better feel for looking long-term instead of just dollar signs at the end of every offload. So the older guys really will sometimes put a damper on like fishing activity just to let things kind of mature a little bit more. They generally kind of have to anyway though, because sometimes they're just not much to catch because things are either too offshore, too deep, or it's really hard to find a big cluster of things. The squid just aren't coming to the light boat that night or whatever it is. So conservation kind of happens naturally as a result of just, you can't fish everything that you see every day.
Absolutely. And those areas get just pounded by the wind.
Yeah.
You know, Santa Barbara, those outer islands, I mean, you could probably only fish it maybe 3 or 4 times a week if you're lucky, just based on weather.
Yeah, they
alone.
Got a couple of areas that are usually pretty safe, like the coves around Catalina and everything. You'll see the light boats there all the time.
Gotcha.
So they're not exactly secret spots or anything, but those are usually more sheltered and everything, and they can get pretty consistent squid fishing there, but sometimes it just doesn't happen. So nature just tells them, like, you're conserving today.
Yeah, right.
Oh, man. Well, you're an angler yourself, right? You like to fish.
I mostly like to scuba dive these days, actually, just because I'm just exploring a whole new realm and everything. But I've definitely done fishing before.
Okay. And do you have any kind of favorite fishing that you typically do or that you used to do a bunch?
I used to actually fish up in Shaver Lake when I lived in Fresno quite a bit. So freshwater fishing there. So I did some fishing there, rainbow trout, that sort of thing. I was a lot younger then, though. My dad, though, he loves fly fishing. That's his big thing. So he'll fly down to south of Chile. He'll fly to Michigan. He just had a big fishing expedition out there this last year. That's so like he loves fly fishing.
That's some of the best trout fishing in the country.
Yeah. Yeah, he had no idea until my uncle actually clued him in that Michigan was like where it's at for fishing.
It's insane. You see these pictures of brown trout and steelhead and things coming out of the rivers and tributaries, and they're huge. And you get them on, you can catch them on anything, but it's mostly fly fishing.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Mm-hmm. And then the Chile, south of Chile, too. Yeah, it's just gorgeous.
Like Patagonia? Yeah, that's amazing.
Exactly. So he loves going down there. He's from Chile to begin with. Oh, so he knows tons of folks and everything, and knows the language and everything. Yeah. So it's also just an opportunity for him to go down and visit family and the country that he's from and everything. But Patagonia is just gorgeous. So even if he doesn't catch anything, he's happy.
Seriously. No. Yeah, that's a bucket list place for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, we got to get you out on a trip with us so you can pull
it,
on a 100-pound bluefin, see what that
Yeah, that'll be exciting.
Yeah. Hell yeah. You know, we've blown through almost an hour and all that stuff. We haven't even talked about what you're currently doing now with Task and Purpose.
Yeah, so I'm doing a little bit different from the maritime side of things, but still research in a way. But I'm one of the research writers and script writers for the Task and Purpose YouTube channel. And that's going to be like a military history, veterans interest kind of YouTube channel. It's also a website, too. I'm just more on the YouTube side. So we tackle everything from like new weapon systems to geopolitics to like what the interaction between the crash of China's economy is with their Taiwan goals, all kinds of stuff that, you know, again, veteran folks would be interested in.
All interesting, especially nowadays.
Yeah.
And you were just at the Gundies at SHOT Show.
Yeah, we got nominated for 3 Gundy Awards. We sadly did not win any of them, but we our host, Chris Cappy, he's a pretty fantastic, really charismatic guy. So he's kind of our spearhead for things, and he was nominated for, I think it was like Best Influencer of the Year, that kind of thing. So Gundies is kind of like a firearms and sports shooting kind of oriented thing. But us being military, we obviously cover firearms a lot and everything. So we still got involved in the Gundies, and I went to SHOT Show and everything to cover the latest developments with different manufacturers were there, all kinds of industry reps, really get a feel of the pulse of the industry.
And I would love to go to SHOT Show one of these years.
It was fun, especially going with the media pass. It was great.
That's about how you get in.
Yeah.
But that's awesome, man. Any special projects coming up on your end? Anything that we need to be on the lookout for?
Well, still working with Task and Purpose. The channel is just completely blowing up. We're up to 1.4 million subscribers, I think, right now.
Wow. That's pretty good. Awesome for you guys. Yes. Right on.
So we're putting out videos. We try it twice a week, but some of the topics are really, really complicated. So sometimes it takes a little bit more to kind of get the research done, the scripts out and everything. And we only have Chris Cappy right now as our host. So it takes a while for him to film all these things.
For sure.
Right, right.
In addition to managing it. But we try to put out videos twice a week, all kinds of different military-related and geopolitics subjects.
Well, congrats on over 1 million subscribers. That's a huge achievement.
Awesome. Thank you.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Well, Diego, before we let you go, give us the rundown on how we get in contact with you, the websites, Task and Purpose, all that good stuff.
Yeah, so where I'm working right now, Task and Purpose, that's the Task and Purpose YouTube channel. And then me specifically, I'm on Instagram as a MilSpec scientist, so that's MilSpec _ scientist. I put all kinds of science memes, my scuba diving videos, that kind of thing on there.
They're great. Oh, I get them. If not daily, weekly, and they're great.
It's how I keep in touch with the science and marine biology side of my life. So,
very cool. Very cool. Well, guys, this was fantastic.
Absolutely. Diego, thank you so for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for driving down.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
This was epic. Tony, you got great friends.
I am very lucky.
Yep. Well, cool. Thank you guys so much for joining us this week on the CCA California podcast. Make sure to go follow us on Instagram at CCA California. Make sure to go follow us on YouTube as well, Coastal Conservation Association of California. Tony, Nate, epic episode.
Absolutely. Like
another good one. Another great one. Excuse me.
Yes. Great one. Not good. Awesome. Diego, thank you so much for coming in once again.
Thank you.
Awesome. Guys, we will see you next week. Take care.